We're privileged today to have Saju with us, giving the Augustana Distinguished Lectures. This is the second one. We had one last evening in Camrose as well. This lecture is titled, But How is His Reason? The Ethical Tradition in Islam. Professor Saju is a scholar in residence at Simon Fraser University's Center for the Comparative Study of Muslim Societies and Cultures. He's the author of Muslim Ethics, Emerging Vistas, and the editor of the Muslim Heritage Series. Dr. Saju earlier served as a human rights advisor for the Justice Department in Ottawa. We have a number of his books here today, Muslim Ethics, Emerging Vistas, which I must admit I found to be both wonderfully eloquent, speaking of the philosophical foundations of these matters in a beautiful and clear way, and then exploring a whole range of issues, biomedical issues and others. I really highly recommend it to you. And the companion to that volume, which he has edited more recently, also Muslim Modernities and several others. And they're available at the back at a deep discount.
An ethical price.
A very ethical price. In fact, Professor Saju was surprised to find one of these volumes here because it is out of print and unavailable every place else in the world. But my good colleague Azim Jaraj seems to have a secret supply hidden away somewhere. So I'm delighted you're here with us. We look forward to your lecture. We only have an hour or a little less than that. We've arranged a room upstairs, 1113, so that we can withdraw there and continue the conversation. Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, David. It's a delight to be here, and once they get the screen going, we can move on with the actual presentation. But what I'll do is I'll take advantage of the AV people getting here to sort of map out what I want to discuss. Essentially, what I'd like to do is, I think there are three command myths about ethics, particularly with regard to ethics that are tied to a religious tradition. And I will be focusing on Islam, but I think that it is not particularly hard to apply the same logic to any of the other great traditions that have produced bodies of ethical thought. And the three myths that I want to focus on come out of the secular narrative of modernity, which is what we discussed last night in Camrose at the lecture that David so graciously arranged and just spoke about. Very briefly, what we discussed last night was that the arc of modernity, historical modernity, from the 16th century onwards, it's not yet. They can't do it, period?
Wow. No, it's about the problem since yesterday on the email team, but I don't know.
Should we switch rooms or anything, since the entire thing is run on slides?
Let me just try and help you.
Yeah, sure. All right. So the proposition is this, that the story of modernity since the 16th century has got a central premise which has become part of the global story simply by the hegemony of that particular narrative. And that is that we've now rationalized, this is Max Weber, you're all familiar with the basics of the theory, that basically you get the rationalization of the public sphere, the economy particularly becomes the driver, and in this rational capital R thrust of modernity, the space in which things pan out is secular. So that is the second great element of the grand narrative of modernity. One, that it's rationalist and the economy is a crucial part of it. Number two, that it works best in secular space. And number three, that in order to do our public reasoning, whether in capital P politics, high politics from the executive and legislatures and so on, or small P politics, what you would do in a student union at the university, that in doing our negotiation, our reasoning, what John Rawls in his theory of justice wants to call public reason, that public reason following elements 1 and 2, right? Rationalization and secularization, that public reason in the name of secularism and rationality must not include religious reasons for any particular choice that you make in the public domain. Okay? So, oh, well done, I think. All right, so, pardon me, that's incredibly rude, but I need to now see if we can cover that. All right, so okay, good. Okay, good. That's where we are. All right, so just to finish the thought there, so the third proposition was that if you want to decide whether in the city of Edmonton you want to build a highway that diverges and gives you a shortcut to this campus, and you invite input and say, is this a smart idea or not? Of all the reasons that you give, you can't justify your reason on the basis that you are influenced by a particular body of religious thought. Why? Because it doesn't fit into the framework of the rational. So that has become the command narrative, that everyone should be able to empathize, to understand, to appreciate, to access the reasoning that you're offering. And you can't make that assumption if the background justification is subjective religious belief. So that has become our command narrative. That is supposed to be from the cover of Muslim Ethics and Noah's Ark. And I like asking students and other workshop participants what they make of this image. And of course, you're smart enough. You know it's Noah's Ark. It's a 16th century South Asian Mughal rendition of the Ark. And the story in the Quran of Noah's Ark is not radically different from what it is in the Bible, though there are a few variations. But it's got all the elements. You had a flood, you had rescue, and so on. So I was doing this session with a very young group of retreat students outside Vancouver, and I asked them what they thought. And just to show you where we're going now, they thought that it was a gay summer camp in which animals but not women were welcome. Go figure. I'm not kidding. So it just shows you how we frame these narratives, And I wasn't sure that I should ask them why they thought that, because I thought then we would have a different seminar altogether. So maybe we can get to that. But here is the arc we've just been talking about. So essentially, it's that whatever your scripture, the Bible, the Old Testament, New Testament, the Quran, there goes tolerance and rational thought. In other words, you have a choice between your faith tradition and rationality and tolerance. You can't have both. And that's the way to go. And our good friend Richard Dawkins, as usual, puts it as bluntly and crudely as you can possibly do. So there we go. I particularly like the wit of Mencken's idea that religion is the policeman of the conscience. That we're not grown up enough to decide that this is right or wrong. We need a cop, and that cop is your religious scripture. Right? Notice how cheap the crafting of that sentence is. For someone who has a following, which I find amongst my students is far greater than that of the Quran or the Bible, etc. I mean, the God delusion is the God scripture of, it seems to me, the 21st century. Very few of my students are familiar with the scriptures. They are very familiar with Dawkins' scripture. So I figured it's only fair we begin with his scripture. But the language that he uses, so moral principles based only upon religion as absolutist. Now, on the face of it, if you read that quickly, you think, yeah, sure, if you're only giving me a religious reason not to build that highway to get to your campus over here, isn't that an absolutist principle? You're saying that I can't build this highway because in my particular denomination, we think that this is way too, oh, shall we say materialistic, or, you know, violates the sanctity of this or that or the other. And so Dawkins wants to tell us that, quote, religion must necessarily not be the place where you can discuss sensibly good and bad, suffering, etc. If you want to have this conversation, you have to go somewhere else. You can't do it in the religion room. There, something else happens. There, people put their hands up and say, that's what the Quran says, that's what the Bible, that's what I do. So we've got, this is the arc of modernity that I was talking about. We've got a secular conversation in which the wall of separation is clinical and in your face and divides the two sides so that you cannot have the rational conversation in the religion room. And so what you get with that is, it seems to me, three inevitable myths. So the first one is that this is what religion does. It's about compliance. You have divine command, or as philosophers say, DCT, divine command theory, that essentially all religious ethics is explained by DCT. So that's myth number one. The second myth, particularly with regard to Muslim ethics, is that why are you spending so much time talking about ethics anyway? What matters in Islam is the Sharia, and the Sharia is law. So aren't you having the wrong debate? It's the second myth. The third one is that since 1 and 2, in other words, religion does, divine command theory, and what matters to Muslims is the Sharia, not ethics, and Sharia is law, therefore ethics can't be relevant. Which is a perfectly logical myth if 1 and 2 are true. It's perfectly sensible to propose that if you haven't got reason on your side, you haven't got law on your side, you're not particularly relevant. Why should we pay any attention to you? Now, it's number 3 that I want to get to, but I can't do that unless we address 1 and 2. So I'm going to do 1 and 2 fairly briskly, and then we will labor the relevance issue, because that then imports arguments 1 and 2. Okay? So far, so good? Are we all on the same page? Please don't be shy. If you're not clear about something, stop me. All right? And then we'll try and do the discussion later, but if there's something that's burning and immediate, we'll do it. So, myth number 1. Now, the funny thing is that cartoon we had where, you know, the holy book falls on your reason and tolerance and rationality doesn't seem to think that it operates under divine command theory. So apparently the scripture itself operates on a different basis. The one resonant appeal in virtually every chapter of the Quran, right, virtually every chapter, is use your heads. It's such a constant refrain. And at times, God sounds so irritable and says things like, if only you would use your reason. You know, like, what's with you? And typically, it has to do with matters which the Quran regards as evidence. So, for example, that you are seeing poverty around you, you are seeing misery around you, therefore, don't you need to think about a proper response? Now, if only you had a heart and a head, you would. That sounds to me like an argument. It doesn't sound like a bossy command. And we will see examples of that. The second problem with the myth is where I get the title for today's session, but what about his, but how is his reason? So that comes from a very well-attested incident, which is part of the hadith tradition in Islam, in which a couple of the companions of the Prophet approach him and want to praise this particular fellow as a particularly worthy member of the community, someone who will contribute. And they say, you know, he's well-connected. He comes to the prayers regularly. He's a marvelous member of the community in Medina. He upholds the constitution and so on. And we should think about putting him in a good place. So the Prophet listens very patiently to all this and then says, but how is his reason? And this guy says, you know, and that's not, I haven't told you everything. You know, his father actually contributed so much to the community, and the prophet this time interrupts him and says, but how is his reason? And this guy still doesn't get it. Just gonna, and then the third time when he says it, he stops and he says, that's what matters? And the prophet nods. You know. Now, it's become a celebrated episode in which the argument that the prophet is making implicitly in the episode is that whether you're talking about something in the Quran or of it, you know, outside of it, that there is simply no escape from the use of reason. Because otherwise, all those great attributes of, you know, wealth, connections, and so on would be sufficient. And the third aspect of that myth, this is such a popular one that even the textbooks that I use in my courses seem to perpetuate that myth, which is this lovely story that in the 9th and the 10th century, you had, you know, this great Stanley Cup standoff, you know, in the Muslim world. You had the Mu'tazilites in the left-hand corner, who were perfectly philosophically reasoned and grounded in Greek Aristotelian ethics, etc. These were the smart guys. They were logical, they were thoughtful, and Al-Jabbar was their prince. Right? Jabbar is, you know, Renaissance man par excellence, very sophisticated, you know, hangs out in Cairo and the great Iranian cities and so on, and writes in sort of the Greek tradition. So, you know, you've got these guys, and then you've got the Asharis, whose great prince is Ghazali, 1058 to 1111. Right? So this is the great standoff, right? And the myth is that by the 11th century, the Asharis had won. The bad guys had won. They were sort of the theologians as opposed to the logical philosophers. The theologians had now won, and therefore Islamic law and ethics and everything was now going to be a matter of taqlid. In other words, you're going to follow what your local leader tells you. So it was compliance, divine command theory, and that the Asharis won. So pervasive is this myth that in order to buy it, you would now have to ignore a whole body of evidence which goes completely contrary to it. Just for the sake of you know, expediency, and we can labor this later if you like, but a quick example of how the myth sounds completely ridiculous when you look at the evidence is that the great age of science in Islam happens after the quarrel. So, for example, Ibn Sina writes the Canon of Medicine in the 12th century. Now, according, and it's a textbook in medical schools in Europe until the early 1600s. An-Nafis is doing, in Cairo, autopsies, he's cutting up bodies and talking about the pulmonary circulation of the blood and you know, the heart processes and so on in the 1200s. And the largest hospital in the Muslim world, the Mansouria in Cairo, is built in the 1200s. According to this myth, it's not possible. Because already the Asharis had won. You could not have science. Because science required you to do what the Mu'tazilites were saying. And that's just one example. I can multiply that. You know, you had the flowering of architecture, the Ottoman Empire comes much later, etc. So this flies in the evidence. And yet people buy that and just think, okay, that's why you've got no reason. So very quickly, when we look at the evidence, this is my favorite quote from that period. It's 1349, and this could be Dawkins. I mean, just look at that. Except, of course, the God that, you know, Al-Khatib wants to, would be a very different God if it were Dawkins. But this guy is the Vizier of Granada, and he writes this because a lot of people refuse to believe that you have contagion. They think the plague is spread because of the wrath of God. And this guy is completely irritated and says, wait a minute, that's a load of crap. That's not why you get, you know, the plague. The reason you get the plague is you're going to dirty places, so clean up. And so they have public baths. That's how you get the Turkish bath, by the way. You know, that it's a very sensible response to the hammam. It's a very sensible response to contagion. Go clean. And here is this guy appealing to God to protect reason. Now, it's 1349. So much for that theory that the Asharites had won, and, you know, now people were all going to be compliant and so on. Let's move on to myth number two. So myth number two is that it's the Sharia that matters. Why are we discussing ethics anyway? And the Sharia is law. No, no. First of all, the Sharia is not law. I mean, one can't say that often enough. It's a body of ethical values, and I'll show you the proof in a half minute. Secondly, the legal tradition, which comes out of the Sharia, which is fiqh, right? This itself, the fiqh tradition, which is a legal tradition, leans very heavily for its authenticity and persuasion on ethics. It is rarely part of state law. All right? It is in places like, you know, Afghanistan under the Taliban, in parts of Somalia controlled by the Al-Shabaab, in parts of Iran, yes. And that's it. Every other Muslim country, you have to go to a local authority who will advise you on what is fiqh. So even there, the binding nature of law leans very heavily on ethics, and we will see how that works. Finally, for those who think that Sharia is a legal code, the obvious answer is, where is it? There is no Sharia book. No one's got a book called, here's the Sharia compendium of rules. Now, the problem with this particular myth is that whenever you claim that you've got a body of law, you know, Canadian law, French civil code, etc., the way you demonstrate is you go to statutes, you go to common law, you know, you've got Blackstone's great commentary on the common law, and you say, look, you know, he's distilled the upshot of what the courts have done. Where are you going to go for the Sharia? There is no such thing as a Sharia code. The nearest we ever got to it was the Majalla of the Ottomans. But the Majalla of the Ottomans was the codified, partially codified Hanafi school which the Ottomans made their state law. So it ignored all the other Sunni schools. It ignored the school of Shafi and Maliki and Hanbali. It ignored all the Shia schools, the Ja'fari and the offshoots and the Zahiris and so on. So this particular Ottoman Majalla code, which is a half-baked Hanafi code, which only applies to certain aspects of public law, is the best you can come up with if you want to claim the Sharia is a code of law. Now, that strikes me as pretty skinny evidence that's where the action is. So what does the Quran say? It's got three references to the Sharia. That's it. And these are the two most commonly cited by people that think that we should treat Sharia as law. Take a look. So 4518, religious path, and 548, right? Assigned a law and a path to each of you. Okay. Now, what's interesting is that where it uses the word law, all right, it couples it with a path. So now there are two ways of reading that. One way of reading that would be to say that there were two things that you got. First, you got the law, and this told you specifically, this is what you must do, and so on. And then on the side, it gave you a path, which people say was sort of the idea of the sacred, the mystical path, spiritual guidance, and so on. And these two diverge. Right? The trouble with that theory is that if you want a body of law which is separate from the path, what's in that body of law? Right? The path, the Quran invokes over and over again, such as that, the religious path, to follow it. You know, there are constant references to that. Right? But here, there is no elaboration of law. So people now pushed to the corner will say, oh, but the second surah of the Quran is where you get all the rules, how you perform the pilgrimage, how you would fast during Ramadan. Most of those rules are in the second surah. It's full of them. Then Surah Nisa, the fourth surah of the Quran, also has several references after talking about, you know, the dominant theme of the status of women. It then has a few rules. And so people will say, if you combine the second and the fourth verse, then you accept it doesn't work. Because the Quran, when it's talking about those things, calls them the path. So now you're really stuck. You've got your law without content. So here is the alternative reading. So the alternative reading is, it's not a law, one box, and path, another box. It's the same box. So in other words, it's using law, not in the sense that we use law at all today. That's anachronistic. That's taking our definition of law and forcing it on something that's revealed in the 7th century. So the most reasonable interpretation of 548, it seems to me, is that the law and the path are one and the same thing. Now, the best evidence that that interpretation is convincing is the word Sharia itself, which comes from Shah, which is Arabic for the way. So now you really put yourself in a corner if you want to insist that Sharia is law, because if it's a path, then where do you, get the authority to put the law in the path box? So it seems to me the combined reading is the most persuasive. The other thing is that 4518 is widely regarded by scholars as a sort of concluding verse. So that the word now is the giveaway. What the Quran is doing here, when you look at the context, is saying, we gave you this large revelation, and now it's done. Now we've given you a path. That sounds pretty much to me as an overarching framework and saying that now whatever you have is in that path. And it seems to me you have to torture the word to insist that it is supposed to be law. Right? And furthermore, if you torture it yet again to then say it's law in the sense we understand it today. In other words, you've got a rule, you've got a sanction, you've got enforcement. Where is the proof of that? It's just not there. Now, here is a major Egyptian scholar who is quoted very widely, as recently as 1983, who explains this, right, in his own terms. Because very often I get people saying, this sounds like a sort of Muslim diasporic interpretation of the Sharia. It's the kind of thing that Muslims do in France and England and Canada and so on. They wouldn't buy this in the Middle East. Well, apparently, that's where it all started. So what Ashmawi is saying here is that we've got principles of virtue, right, which he wants to call the Sharia. Principles of virtue to be interpreted sounds to me terribly like ethics. Huh? And he's not done yet. He then wants to say, as far as law is concerned, you've got this man-made body of rules, not sacred, even when it claims inspiration from the Sharia. So this is an establishment Egyptian scholar saying that. This is not a diasporic, liberal Western Muslim interpretation at all. Ashmawi is a highly influential Egyptian jurist, held in high regard at the Al-Azhar establishment, and so on. And here is someone that you may know, because he was just here a week ago and came from our location at Simon Fraser University. And here, An-Naim is even more blunt about it. Now, there is no country which has a body of law to which you can have this attribute. If compliance is voluntary, it's not law. The whole point about law is you've got no choice. Oh, I didn't feel like, going at 40 miles per hour. I just felt like speeding here, That's not law, right? And this idea that you can't enforce it precisely because it's principles of virtue, Ashmawi, is the whole point about ethics. So what I'm suggesting is that you're on really thin ice if you want to say that law is what defines Muslim civilization and Islam as a faith tradition and so on, first proposition. And then you're still on thin ice if you're then going to claim that not only does law do it, but that law is encased in Sharia. I suggest wrong on both grounds. The Sharia is not law, it's ethics. And secondly, this is the really fascinating thing. Three references in the Quran, and scholars have not been able to find any references to Sharia in any of the first 200 years of Muslim religious writing. First 200 years. So through the 600s, 700s, middle 800s, no one wants to talk about the Sharia. Not the Prophet, not the companions. We can't find the use of the term. Now that's interesting. If it was such a divine, it was, this is it. This is the defining characteristic of Muslim civilization. It's intriguing that no one seems exercised about it when the foundations are being laid. So why did it become so important? That's a wonderful story. Why the Sharia became so important has to do with identity, with encountering other civilizations, with the need for, sounds familiar, politicians needing to enforce their particular body of law, and therefore saying, oh, by the way, it would rather help if I called myself the shadow of God on earth and said this is sacred. They still try and do it, you know, except the sacred is defined in whatever way will work locally. So you want to appeal and say, I'm not doing this, this is from God. Okay, but then it's political. That's political reason. So the scholarly evidence is simply not there of the Sharia as the defining characteristic at all. The third myth is what I wanted to get to because I think it sort of unravels one and two in action. So the third myth is that religion and secular problems and challenges don't mix. Religious ethics, even if it's, you know, if it's not law and it's not divine command, what you do with religious ethics is you apply it to religion. It's how you conduct your pillars of Islam. It's how you conduct the fast. It's how, you know, you would encounter people in the mosque. Why do you want to apply it in secular space? It's not relevant there. So that's the first argument. Except that division does not actually occur, as we will see in the Quran itself. Secondly, what I want to suggest is that very early on, Muslim scholars, jurists, thinkers developed an idea called maslaha, which is simply the public good. And the reason they developed this theory had to do with the fact that they thought that the Muslim empires, in the plural, the Ottoman Empire, you had the Abbasids, etc., were getting a bit too legalistic, and they weren't amused, these scholars and jurists, that rulers seemed to have a habit of claiming that whatever, you know, kanun, law which they passed, had to do with, you know, divine command and so on. And these Jews were getting a bit irritated and thinking, you know what? These guys seem to have developed the sacred habit now. You know, anytime they want to boss over us. So they developed this new idea of maslaha. And what they said was, never mind how strict the law is. If it is not in the public good, you have to look elsewhere. Now you can see how that would get a bossy ruler into trouble. Because now if you pass a self-interested law, a rule, and the jurists say, this is not in the public interest. This is in your interest. Then by doing the standoff, they just think, so we have to look elsewhere now. They're pulling the rug out. And I want to show you that this is not just a theory. We do it now. So we do it in practice in multiple fora. So let's step back a little bit. So this is what the Quran says, and it's the second surah, which is where the rules come from. Now, notice what the Quran does not regard as piety, which is the strongest term you can use in any faith about compliance with the sacred, piety. So this is how it defines it. That's a pretty sarcastic verse. Because, as many of you will know, what it's referring to in that opening sentence is something that Muslims do when they say their prayers. In the course of a ritual prayer, before the close, you look to the east and you look to the west. It's a very, very old ritual before you conclude the prayer. And the idea is symbolic. It's a very powerful looking to the east and the west. It is that God does not belong to the east or the west. He's everywhere, right? That you look to the God of the east, the God of the west. No one owns God. It's not that. So you're acknowledging in humility that God is everywhere. And the Quran is taking that important symbolic gesture, which is deference to God, and saying it's not piety. That's a pretty telling thing coming from Scripture. And it says that's not the measure of your piety, that you are acknowledging God. This is what is a measure of your piety. It's what you do. And so it's now taking piety as simply acknowledging the sacred, and it's taking piety as social applied solidarity with the disadvantaged, and saying number two trumps number one. So then And time again, you know, again, we can labor this if you like later on. You know, there are famous hadiths of the Prophet in which he's challenged and he's told, but what is the real Islam? What's the bottom line? And time and again, he comes up with that answer. That it's fine to do the prayers, it's fine, you should do that, it's good. But what really matters is how kind you are to people that need you, how much solidarity you have. Did you give to the poor when they were hungry? If you didn't, it doesn't matter how often you come to the mosque. So the test is becoming ethical practice already in the Quran. The way maslaha comes out of that, I put in, it's not masala, by the way, which is, people say, I've heard that word before. Isn't that masala you mean? Is that a typo there, you know? And I found that in an Indian restaurant, you know. No, that was, it's not actually in the public good. Masala is pretty dangerous stuff. May or not even the private good, never mind the public good. So, now, with maslaha, this guy, Ghazali, who gets such a bad rap from, you know, the Asharites versus the Mu'tazila thing, he's the bad guy for everybody. It's like he was the theologian that killed reason, you know, and that's it. So when he dies in 1111, reason is dead in the Muslim world. That's it's all over. And yet, this is the guy who cooked up maslaha because he had the authority, right? So Ghazali's coining of maslaha already lays the foundations, which is, when in the course of applying the Sharia as fiqh, you get into conflict, you need to have some priorities. And the priorities are the maqasid, the important principles, which are essentially the protection of faith, the intellect and wisdom, the protection of lineage, right? And basic communal property. So what they're saying is, that's what the Sharia is really about, the maqasid. Both as an ethical body of values and as fiqh in terms of the applied rules. But the real prince of maslaha is Shatibi, 1388. Now, Shatibi is an Andalusian scholar, southern Spain. And not many people have heard of him because this guy is pacing up and down. He's a very, very fine scholar. He's pacing up and down thinking, you know what? The law is getting the better of religion here. We've got too many rules now. We've developed rules about, you know, how you dress when you go to do this, and where how you do the cleaning rituals before you go to pray. Not enough to be clean. Now you've got to do it, you know, in five particular ways. And Shatibi is saying, we're losing the point. We've just got rules without figuring out why. And isn't that rational? So he wants to now take away, again, this idea that, you know, the legal secular is the domain of reason, and so on. From a religious point of view, he wants to challenge, no, it's not the domain of reason, the domain of rules. It's not the same as reason. And so he develops this whole theory now, based on Ghazali. He takes it and he writes the great masterpiece on the Maqasid. This is way back, right, in the 14th century. And so what you get is, that's his great book, Shatibi, and that's a sort of imagined sketch of who he was. Nafis is my favorite guy, because this fellow in Cairo is the fellow that actually discovered pulmonary circulation of the blood. Now, what's amusing is that Meir Bir, who is the West's finest scholar in Islamic medicine, had written in his account, which is used everywhere, this is the history of Islamic medicine, and Meir Bir just said, Nafis was a very fine scholar, but there is no way that he beat William Harvey to it, whom we give credit for discovering the circulation and so on, for one reason, that Nafis was a Muslim, therefore he must have followed the Sharia, therefore he couldn't do autopsies, because under Sharia and fiqh, you're not supposed to sort of, you know, cut up the body because that you know, damages it in the eyes of God. And so it hurts the integrity of the body. It defiles it. And so, theoretically, he could not have done it. Now, here's the funny thing. If you actually read Nafis's great book, and luckily for us it survived, his great book on the body, right at the beginning of the book, he's got an introduction in which he does what Muslim scholars always did and say, here I am presenting my evidence, but God knows best. All right? It's a classic way for a scholar to finish a work and say, I've tried my best, but I don't know everything. There are many things which are beyond me, and God knows best.
So he puts that acknowledgement in his introduction. Furthermore, he says that I've tried to be a good Muslim and to follow the principles of the Sharia, and this is the best that I've been able to come up with. Mayor Beer read that and thought that therefore he was Sharia compliant and so could definitely not do autopsies. Now, if you actually flip the book, especially the original, untranslated version, there are minute diagrams of the lungs, of the inside of the body, and so on. So you have to believe that he cut up maybe animals and so on, no cadavers, no human cadavers at all, and then somehow managed to figure out this is how the inside of a human body looks, and then he figured out how circulation happens in humans. So he did all this, if he managed to do that without autopsies, he's truly a genius. But in fact, we have now got a whole body of evidence saying that what he did was he went to the local imam in Cairo and just said, can you please give me permission to go to the main hospital and do autopsies? And the imam tells him, you don't want to do what? And he says, look, if you allow me to cut these bodies up, I'm going to help you fight contagion. Because I will be able to tell you how the body works, and we will be able then to fight disease. And this guy says, you really can do that? And he says, yeah, maslaha. He wins. There is not a single line of evidence that anyone issued a fatwa or any warning against An-Nafis and told him, stop cutting up bodies. Apparently it was cool. It was fine. So here you get, 13th century, this is done, the Mu'tazilites have lost, the Asharites have won, there is no reason. And here you get a scientist in Cairo doing autopsies. So much for that. Now, what I want to get to is this, and I will labor the maslaha in a moment. What I want to argue is the central core of the relevance of ethics, that the third myth is wrong, that ethics is simply in the religious sphere, is that people think that if you say that religious ethics should prevail, then what you're saying is it should become part of the law or the command framework of the state. In other words, they want to put ethics there, which it seems to me is a monumental blunder, because as soon as you ask the state to be the custodian of your ethics, it's not ethics. It has to be voluntary. It has to be your preference, all right, regardless of whether the law is now overlapping with it or not. Regardless of whether the law says smoking is allowed or not, if you think that smoking is damaging to your health, it's irresponsible, your family depends on you, you make an ethical choice. If the state tells you not to smoke or they'll fine you, it's not an ethical choice. It's got a legal penalty. It changes the character of the rule entirely, right? So what I'm suggesting is that when we say public ethics, we do not mean that it belongs at the level of the state. We mean it belongs in civil society. And civil society is the space between the state and you and me as individuals. It's public domain, right? It is not controlled by the state. The state must look after the rule of law. It must make sure that civil society is well governed, etc., and then get out of the way. Civil society is what we do. This class is civil society. What U of A does, right, the educational field, because it's not a state-controlled university. If it were, if the province of Alberta said education is a provincial responsibility under the BNA, therefore we get to write your syllabus, not civil society, then it's state-run. But since that's not the case, right, this is civil society. My suggestion is that that's where ethical values are nurtured. That's where you get public ethics. The moment you take it out of here and put it there, it becomes state command fiqh. It becomes law, which is enforced by the state. In other words, you're completely altering the character of ethics if you put it outside of civil society. And to give you examples of how it's actually applied, that's the one I'm going to labor for a few minutes. Biomedical choices, whether it's stem cells, organ transplants, end-of-life decisions, abortions, same-sex unions, the entire field of biomedical ethics, we have to ask questions that go far beyond the law. In fact, there's very little law. The law tries to make minimum rules and get out of the way and just say, you decide whether you think it's appropriate or not. The second area is environmental stewardship. We think environmental ethics are deadly important now. I mean, the whole business of global warming and so on. In fact, It's ethics which is trying to make the law more sensitive. We are the ones pushing, as citizens, telling governments, by the way, you better care about this. You know, acid rain matters, what you're doing with oil pipelines matters, and you know about that in Alberta. Those are ethical debates the law is very slow in following. A third and fourth area, civic ethics, huge issue now, public accountability, you know, cheating in government, corruption. We even have measures of that, civic ethics, right? And the final one, economic ethics. Well, today, arguably, that is the most burning issue. You know, what banks do, what financiers, what's the Occupy Wall Street movement about? That's economic ethics. And I couldn't resist that particular cartoon from the World Trade Organization. So it is, this is the area. This is the area where you get a standoff in which people have a critique of poverty, of economic choices, and say, wait a minute, what you're doing has very little to do with the public good. So what you're challenging the public domain with is maslaha. You may call it something else in the Western tradition or somewhere else, but that's what we're doing. Now, what I want to do is give you three quick examples from bioethics. All right? Of how this actually works. So here is one historical example. Okay, so what happens with Mohammed Abdu, whom the British give a particularly hard time in exile and so on? So 1899, he becomes the Mufti of Egypt. Very important because that makes him a very senior sort of legislator in Cairo. Right? And what he does is he insists. All right. That autopsies, he's still now trying to resist conservatives who want to say, oh, but you're defiling the body and so on. He applies ijtihad, which is the term for reasoning, not just legal reasoning, but moral reasoning. And he says, wait a minute, it's in the public good. He wins. After that, the Egyptian civil code makes it legal and required to do autopsies in cases where death occurs under suspicious circumstances. And the only way that it became part of the civil code is because from the Azhar, Abdu was arguing that it's in the public good. So he overcame conservative resistance. Right? This is a matter of historical record. We've got the details of the argument, and he prevails. So here is another one, organ donations. Now, so much for the theory that this is divine command. So Sheikh Sharawi famously comes up with the slogan, our bodies belong to God. In fact, there have been books written both in Arabic and English about, you know, that particular claim. And so on the basis of that, he was saying, you can't give kidneys. They're not yours. You are a custodian of your body. Your body belongs to God, so you can't just give away a kidney. Perfectly logical if you follow the first proposition literally, that, you know, you have only got to have a duty of care to your body, and then you can't. So the Grand Mufti, Said Tantawi, who passed away very recently, he counters Sharawi and just says, wait a minute, what that means, that you are custodian of your body in the traditional, is that if you fall ill, you can't say that, oh, if I feel like it, maybe I'll take antibiotics and so on. You've got a moral duty to take care of your body. If you're a pregnant woman, you've got a moral duty to the fetus. In other words, you must, you know, avoid drugs, smoking, if you think it'll damage the fetus. That's what custodianship means. It doesn't mean you can't give away an organ. In fact, he turned around and said, in the eyes of God, you are much better if you give away your second kidney. You don't particularly need it. Somebody else does. Do it. And that's affirmed. Again, that argument wins on the basis of the public good. There is a large conservative following in Egypt, which is coming out particularly now with the Arab Spring and all that, which follows Sharawi. And we just had a seminar at UVic on organ donations, in which an Egyptian scholar was telling us how she actually did field work in southern Egypt. And where people had low levels of literacy, the lower the level of literacy, the more likely they followed Sharawi. As soon as they had an education, were urbanized, paid attention to the latest scholarship, they were all familiar with what the Mufti were saying, and were saying, we better give kidneys because we've got a desperate shortage. And Egypt is in a real crisis as far as organ donation is concerned. And this is really fascinating. So Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia now all have organ donor systems, just as Canada does. Now, Turkey, not surprising. You would say, you know, basically they've got a secular civil code, you know, modeled on the Belgium. Iran and Saudi Arabia. Places which people think of as, in fact, Iran's kidney distribution system is now so sophisticated and fully computerized, has been used as a model by the WHO, the World Health Organization, as something developing countries should follow. That's a hell of a compliment for, you know, supposedly following divine command theory. So there, again, the myth comes apart. Here is a third example. Now, this is a little bit unnerving. People with weak stomachs, you may leave the room. Okay. So, fetal disability abortion. This has become a very, very hot issue in bioethics. Traditionally, you can't do an abortion. The conservative response is that, you know, you must be patient, you must put up with hardship, etc. Except for two grounds, same in Jewish law, which is the life of the mother or to protect her health. Those are the two sort of classical grounds back from the 8th century. They were accepted as grounds for an abortion. Right? Not in the Catholic tradition, but certainly in the early Jewish tradition and in the Muslim tradition. But now, in more and more countries, and here are examples, Iran already, Indonesia, Turkey, Tunisia, okay, if there is, and the ethical argument is very, very strong, it must be a permanent impairment of the fetus. You've got evidence that a fetus is going to have a permanent and severe disability. Classic example, brain damage, that the brain has not descended at all, it's encephalic, so you've got an empty skull, all right? Or the heart is in such poor shape that you're going to have a child that is permanently and severely disabled, all right? The abortion is allowed. It's a completely new ground. It does not occur, and you can see why it's a new ground. How would you know about the disability? Only if you've got surveillance tools. In other words, you have to be able to do ultrasound. If you can't do ultrasound, you don't know about fetal disability. It's a completely late modern innovation. All right? Now, France and the UK have actually got specific fetal disability allowance rules. So the national health system in both countries will help you, which they won't if it's a voluntary abortion. If it's a fetal disability abortion, you can actually apply for permission. A lot of Muslim countries are doing that too. And Indonesia is the latest addition. In fact, I had to put that in shortly before I did this presentation because part of my research I discovered that passed a law now. And guess what? In all those four countries, the religious establishment had a debate about it and decided it was in the public interest. It's the trumping of maslaha again. No amount of fiqh, no amount of classical rules were strong enough to overturn the argument that this was in the public good. Now, people get very nervous about that and say, can it not easily become a convenient thing? All right? That you don't want to have an abortion, so now you've got a doctor to certify. In fact, you should take a look at the legislation. It's available online. It's very strict. You need two doctors independently to attest. You need written evidence. All right? And then the state is going to verify that this is true. The disability has to be very serious. Right? And when you can do it depends on the particular school. But here is a classic example of maslaha. So, implications. Now, what I'm saying is that maslaha, even though we call it the public good, is not a contest with the individual good. It expands individual choice. Because people think right away, if it's public good, what if it clashes with your decision? And the answer gives you more options, not less. And the second really important thing is it can't be utilitarian. So public good does not mean what utilitarian ethics or utilitarian philosophy tells you, which is simply count the numbers, majority. In utilitarian thinking, it's if it benefits the greatest number of people, it's good. No, there are red lines. The red lines are there are some things you can't do, even if everybody wants it. You must have that in ethics. You have that always in ethics, right? For example, you can't torture somebody to get out a secret which you determine to be in the public interest. We just regard that as a red line. You can't torture, period. It's a red line. And so the red lines here is, for example, you cannot consent to suicide or to female genital mutilation. It's not allowed. So it's simply against moral principles, right? or forcible extraction of organs, a very important red line when organ transplants and donations were allowed. So the idea is, in case people think that the public good is a material calculus, it's not. It's got moral red lines to protect it, right? And we've got lots of interesting trends. I'm noticing that we're running out of time, so I want to wrap it up. When in 2005 we had an international meeting, the most important meeting we've had in global bioethics so far, almost every Muslim country sent a delegation and participated in that declaration, and they affirmed it, all right, on bioethics and human rights. You've got several examples where professional associations now have got hybrid codes of ethics in which they use what we would regard as Western professional ethics, especially in bioethics, and then they introduce maslaha, that you must introduce the idea of what is the communal idea of the public good, and both come together in the codes, right? And if we had time, we'd talk about Wasilenko in Calgary. He's done some amazing work on bioethics in which they're very sensitive to this idea of counseling in producing thoughtful decisions about end-of-life decisions and so on. And again, the classic thing that Wasilenko is doing is public good. Right? Maslaha. All right. So I want to leave you. I'm done.
We can stay here.
We can stay here?
Yes, we can.
All right, cool. Okay. So I, in fact, have a quote from the University of Alberta. I couldn't resist that, about ethical literacy, which it seems to me is pretty appropriate given that when my students give me final papers and I tell them about the plagiarism rules, I notice how often, if I tell them what the penalty is, they'll take notes. And they'll write down what, you know, what could go wrong and so on. If I just say, please don't plagiarize, yeah, okay, you know, it's time to go. That's the gap between law and ethics. In fact, another way of putting it is, ethics is what you do when no one's watching. The law is what you do because you know that the state is watching, right? And this idea of ethical literacy, we haven't developed the language yet. Never mind in religious ethics, not even in secular ethics. And it seems to me that if we define ethical literacy as doing what Rawls wants to tell us is admissible public reason, we're leaving out a very rich body of ethics which predates that. And the ethical reasoning we've already seen goes back, you know, in Islam, certainly, very powerfully to the 10th, 11th, 12th centuries. All that would be shut out. So we would be doing bioethics without memory. We would be saying, you know, I'm just focusing on the here and now. You know, I'm not particularly concerned about the inheritance and so on. To go back to that picture, now that we've got a couple of more minutes, but before I wind up, what I want to ask you is that, are you able to see, can we dim the lights in the front? Or even in the room at large, so that you can see the image perhaps more clearly.
I wonder if that's as good as it gets there.
All right, I was trying to
see it pretty clearly.
Well, okay, good. Can you see anything in that painting which you would deem to be formally religious? I've had some fascinating suggestions to that, and let's see how inventive you get. But anything you would say, oh, that's religious.
What's the guy in green and white holding?
You mean right here at the top?
No, the guy next to the guy in the clergy.
With the sail.
The guy in the rain.
With the sail, right here?
No, the other guy with the white cloak.
Okay, you'll go
next to the naked guy.
There? Ah, remember, it's a gay forum, right? So, oh, these two are in conversation and he's got a book. We have absolutely no idea what it is. But he is holding a book, yeah.
That one was praying.
Who is praying? I don't see anyone praying.
The one who's
looking
up.
Oh, no. He's holding a rope which connects to that.
Oh, okay.
Please.
Yeah, I'm trying. Those people are trying to save somebody who's falling in the crocodile.
That's a very sophisticated answer. That's where I was going, of course. Yeah, you're.
I read your mind. Well, the act of rescue, what's interesting about that, in fact, I had this conversation with someone about the book yesterday, and she was saying, why is he saving this other guy? It was a leading question. She wanted to see what I would respond. And I said to her, why do you think? And she said, well, I have no idea, because we have no reason to believe that... Are you able to see the rescue act? Yeah? Mm-hmm. We have no idea if they know each other. Now, when Miskin, who is the genius mogul painter who produced this, in fact, we think Miskin was a Christian convert to Islam, and that he was familiar both with the biblical narrative. We don't know if this is true, but that's some of the speculation. And Miskin, M-I-S-K-I-N, really cool painter, and as far as he was concerned, what little notes we have, the guy in red is a stranger. This is the Good Samaritan argument. He's just saving somebody who would drown otherwise. He's not connected with him. There are no compelling reasons. You know, this is no different from the idea of you must help the stranger. Now, when people see that, they think, well, okay, it's an act of rescue. That's not what Miskin thought. We know that Miskin actually was completely familiar with the surah in the Quran, which refers to this account. All right, and Noah is Nu in Arabic, and so in the Quran, the story of Nu, N-U-H, all right, is told very similarly. But there's something very interesting. A couple of times the Quran says, "As you know." Now, why would the Quran say, "As you know"? It assumes you're familiar with the other story, with the prior biblical account. Now, what's also intriguing is you know where the biblical account comes from. In fact, the story of Noah and the flood predates the Bible. It predates the Old Testament. It's in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is one of the great epics of the Middle East, and predates the Old Testament by several centuries. And in Stephen Mitchell's recent translation of the Epic of Gilgamesh, the account of the flood, this is you know, a completely folk story, that there was a great flood, that there was an ark, and there was saving. And this is in the entire story of Gilgamesh, in full detail, long before it's part of Scripture. Now, what's interesting is the appropriation of that story. Some people find that to somehow diminish the importance of the scriptural story. I think the opposite. I don't think it diminishes the scriptural power at all. In fact, what you're doing is you're taking a story that people are familiar with and putting new moral meaning in it. The appropriation of the secular and then the injection in it of new moral meaning is what religion has always been about. So the Hajj, the pilgrimage, is regarded as, for example, one of the pillars of Islam. It was practiced before Islam. People came to Mecca, the Kaaba had idols in it, and Muhammad famously, when he comes back from Medina, he comes up. But it was a site of pilgrimage before Islam. But then it's appropriated in the name of the faith tradition, acquires new meaning. And that is true of virtually every major religious principle. The veil, for example, which people think is sacred, etc. We know from detailed evidence that Byzantine Christian women of the upper class veiled. And that they did it as a status symbol, to protect themselves, to give a signal that, you know, I come from those classes, don't mess with me. Muslim women liked that. They thought, okay, you know, this is a cool idea. And then it becomes a social custom, and there you go. These appropriations are very common. It seems to me that in this picture, the nearest we get to the religious account is precisely the act of saving the stranger, which in the Quranic account is what the entire ark story is about. It's about the flood, the test, you know, the strength of character, and with the saving of the animals too. You know, it's fascinating what the moral account of that is. And what I want to suggest to you is I see no separation of sacred and secular in this painting. That to me is the point, that the ethical act of salvation knows no wall of separation. That it's simply, you do the right thing. You don't put up your hand and say, oh yeah, but am I doing that because it's a divine command? You know. So it seems to me that this notion that ethics one is about complying with rules. Number two, that religious ethics is about complying with divine rules. And number three, that the law, not ethics, is the defining feature. All three of them make assumptions which I think collapse when we look at the evidence. Okay, I'm going to stop here.